Chapter 13. The Istuli Plains. A quote from Agensis, the third analytic of men. Gods are epical beings, not quite alive. Since the now eludes them, they are forever divided. Sometimes nothing blinds souls more profoundly than the apprehension of the whole. Men need recall this when they pray. Summer, 20, New Imperial Year, 4132, Year of the Tusk. The High Istuli. 3 days Sorweel waited after learning of the Nonman Embassy and the Nyam. Saranga refused even to countenance the possibility of his departure. Even though he had seen the Nonman Embassy firsthand, the successor prince continued insisting the entire thing was a kind of Anasarimba deceit. Sorweel was Narindari, he insisted, chosen by the gods to exorcise the cancer that was the Aspect Emperor. Just wait, Saranga said. The goddess will intervene. Something auspicious will happen. Some twist will keep you here, where you can discharge your fate. Wait and see. And what if they know? Sorweel finally asked, voicing the one alternative they had passed over in silence, that the Anasarimba had somehow guessed the Dread Mother's divine conspiracy. They don't know.
But what? They don't know!
Saranga, so he was beginning to realize, possessed the enviable ability to yoke his conviction to his need, to believe absolutely whatever his heart required. For Sorweel, belief and want always seemed like ropes too short to bind together, forcing him to play the knot as a result. Faced with yet another sleepless night, he once again struck out through the encampment for the Swadyali enclave, determined to confront Sorweel with pointed questions. But the guardsman denied him entry to the granary, saying the Grand Mistress conferred with her Holy Father over the horizon. When he refused to believe them, they called for the nuns.
"Cap your gourd," a spice-eyed witch teased. "Soon the Grand Mistress will be skipping you like a stone across water."
Sorweel walked back to his tent in a stupor, at once dismayed at the capricious ways of fate, and thrilled, sometimes to the point of tingling breathlessness, at the prospect of spending so much time with his enemy's daughter. "Well?" Saranga cried when he returned. "You are my brother, are you not?" Sorweel asked, pulling free the small purse that Porsperian, or the goddess, had given him. It seemed dull and unremarkable in the sunlight, despite the golden crescents embroidered across it. "I need you to keep this." As High Keeper of the Horde, he knew enough about Kore to know that it would wreck whatever sorcerer's contrivance Serwa had prepared for them, concealed or not. "So you are leaving," the successor prince said, taking the pouch with a blank air of incomprehension. "It's a family heirloom," Sorweel offered by way of lame explanation. "An old totem. It will bring you luck. Only so long as you don't know what it contains." This struck the young king as plausible enough, given that he had been forced to improvise. Many charms required some small sacrifice, beans that could not be eaten or wine that could not be quaffed. But Saranga scarcely looked at the thing, let alone pondered it. In his eyes, Sorweel was the divine weapon.
"This cannot be," he cried. "You! You are the one! She has chosen you!"
Sorweel could do no more than shrug with weary resignation. "Apparently, he has chosen me as well." The following morning, none other than Anasarimba Moyngus himself came to fetch him before the interval's toll. The Prince Imperial was predictably menacing, not merely for his glare and feral physique. Like many of the ordeal's outriders, he had taken to ornamenting his gear with fetishes cut from the shrank. Most riders used shriveled digits and blackened ears, but Moyngus, for some unfathomable reason, had their teeth braided across the hems of his nimal hauberk. Because of the way they refused, the things seemed peculiarly inhuman. Small, curved combs of enamel, with three pairs of roots to a tooth.
The Prince Imperial watched with bored amusement as Sorweel dressed and gathered his gear. Saranga, who sat watching Moengus, could not keep his peace.
"Nilgicus is a myth," he said with open contempt. "There is no Nonman king."
Moengus shrugged, picked a curl from his wild black mane to study.
"So says Zayum.
So says Zayum."
Something about Zaranga's assertion, its pious confidence, perhaps, hooked the Prince Imperial's attention.
"Tell me, what has your father accomplished with all his Zayumi wisdom?
How to avoid marching into wastes to die, among other things."
"Other things,"
Moenga snorted,
"like surrendering his son as a hostage."
Zaranga glared at the man, speechless. Moengus's presence seemed too oppressive for any real verbal exchange. So, heavy with pack and shield, Sorweel simply clasped fingers with his friend. He smiled in the pretense of manliness, ignored the abject worry in Zaranga's green gaze. Then, with the giddy sense of toppling from some ledge of happenstance, he turned to follow the Prince Imperial toward the granary. The interval had told by this time, so the encampment roiled with activity. Anna Sarimba Moengus paid no attention whatsoever to the warriors falling to their faces about them. He walked as though this simply were the way, the world abasing itself at his booted feet. As though he truly were an Anna Sarimba. The granary seemed another world, crowded as it was with women bustling in florid silk. Given the strict apportioning of duty and labor in Sarkarpus, Sorweel could not but think of the kitchens and fulleries of his father's palace, the only places in his narrow experience where the voices of men did not predominate. He was not scandalized, though he suffered the vague sense that he should be. Anna Sarimba Serwa stood near the entrance of her pavilion, dispensing last-minute instructions to a small crowd of petitioners. She dismissed them the instant she glimpsed their approach, speaking some language Sorweel failed to recognize. The sun had climbed above the enclave's eastern rim, catching her flaxen hair in a brilliance that mimicked her father's haloed hands. A hush fell across the congregated witches who, almost without exception, ceased their small labors to turn and watch their grand mistress greet the newly arrived men. Sorweel glanced from face to face, feeling more than a little conspicuous. More than a few of the nuns, he realized, blinked tears. He suffered the sense yet again of blundering into dangers that only others could appreciate. He turned to find Serwa standing nearby. Despite the craftsmanship of her leather jerkin and leggings, seemed almost absurdly plain in comparison to the billows worn by her sisters. But she and her brother shouldered packs that had been waiting them in the dust.
"Come," she said, her arm lowered to receive his waist. "You must hold me tight."
Moengus already stood hulking in her slip embrace. Sorweel glimpsed his eyes grinning at him over the flaxen arc of her head.
"You get used to the reek," he said when the young king hesitated.
Only several of the nuns laughed, few enough to underscore the anxiousness of the others. They loved her, Sorweel realized, the way King Harweel's men had loved him. He stepped into the soft sphere of her touch and perfume scent. Despite his male hauberk, he started like an unbroken colt at her touch. She pulled him tight to her side, and he felt her spine arch to an inexplicable exertion. She leaned her head back, and he fairly cried out for the blue-white light shining from her mouth and eyes, so brilliant as to blacken her sunburned face. Moengus's laughter slipped through the chinks of her arcane call. A fog rose about them, scored with glowing, parabolic lines. The dawn's shadow world dimmed. There was a binding, a sense of straps whipping about his body, immobilizing him, heaving him in a thousand simultaneous directions, and then the slip, as if he folded along occlusions in reality. Whipping light, then lurching, coming to be, as if he were a thing rotted, yanked clear of his grave. He was on his knees, retching. He felt the fleeting press of Sirwa's hand, as if she tested his bodily integrity. He spent several moments spitting into dust and balding turf. Then he staggered toward the Imperial siblings, where they sat on the crest of a low berm. He had assumed they were watching him, but their gaze remained unbroken when he stepped beyond its angle. Craning his head back, he saw regions of dust steaming across the horizon. The army of Middle-North, he realized, preparing to resume its long march to Golgotharath. Of the men of the Circumfix, he could only glimpse the outermost assemblies, clouds of black specks snaking beneath the dun plumes. He turned back to Sirwa and Moengus. "I am my father's daughter," she said, answering his questioning look. "But I am not my father." Her eyelids fluttered against some unearthly drowsiness. "Medinostic cants are trying for me." He took an unceremonious seat at her side, found himself looking down. Such was the lure of her gaze.
"Fate is indignity," he heard her say.
"What do you mean? The king of Sarkarpus, the city famed the world over for hoarding Koray, now finds himself whisked across the sorcerous ether, and by a woman, no less."
"I hadn't considered it," he said with fuming wariness. "You lose track of the indignities after a while."
She smiled in what seemed genuine humor. "The cant of translocation," she went on to explain, "could take them only to the space of horizon, less if her vision were obscured. The cant's difficulty was such that she could successfully hold its meaning only after at least two watches of sleep. She was lucky, she said, if she could complete two translocations a day, unlike her divine father, who could cross endless leagues in that time, stepping from horizon to horizon. So you will vomit," she said, "and I will snooze, day in and day out, until we come to Ishtarabinth." "And why the holy princess snores and farts and mumbles," Moengus said, leaning his shaggy-maned head low to see past his sister. "You and I will hunt." "And the Shrank?" Sol-Will asked, speaking with a confidence he did not feel. "We'll do everything they can to bugger our corpses," the Prince Imperial replied, staring off. Clenching his teeth against the tailings of his nausea, Sol-Will turned back to regard their mighty fraction of the great ordeal. "So many men, believing unto death." The Horde retreated, scraping the horizon, and the four armies marched into its desolate wake. Thus far, the army of the Middle-North, under Anna Sarimber Cayudis, charged with the extreme left flank, had confronted the greatest concentration of the abominations. For the Shrank sustained themselves on the fruits of the grave, worms and grubs, and so multiplied according to the richness of the earth. Though Cayudis did not so much as lay eyes on lost Kunieri, his army lured innumerable clans from its forested frontiers. And so the Horde had accumulated in disproportion, mobbing to the west and thinning to the east, until, like gravel heaped upon a balance beam, it had tipped and come crashing. Now it was the army of the south, under King Umrapathur of Nilnamesh, that found itself most besieged. For as the great ordeal crawled ever northward, the Noliost, the famed misty sea, sheltered it to the west, while the high Istuli yawned, ever more infinite, to the northeast. Word of the Israzi Horo, the Shining Men, spread far among the high northern clans, and the Shrank came mobbing from over the horizon, a never-ending trickle of inhuman lust and wicked arms. They rutted and howled. They scoured the depleted earth. They battled over the carcasses of the dead, devoured their offspring. They blotted the earth with their multitudes. For weeks the great ordeal had cleaved to a northern course, skirting the more broken lands to the west. But as they drew abreast of the Noliost, the four armies had veered westward, forcing King Umrapathur to pivot with reference to his foe, and so position the mad masses before him across his right flank. He understood the dangers, for as a long-time veteran of the Unification Wars, he had fought many mortal campaigns. To drag your foe on your flank was to court disaster. Yet he put his faith in his holy aspect emperor, knowing that his lord and god understood this risk far better than he did. But his men were not so sanguine. King Ercmacthe of Girgash especially troubled him with dire pronouncements in council, as did the sinister Carindusu, the grand master of the sorceress Vokalati. For they spent their days in the shadow of the sandstorm, fencing with the shrieking multitudes. "When we drove them before us," Carindusu said, his oiled face held high and imperial, "fear was their contagion. Now we drag them upon our boards. They answer more and more to their hunger." Indeed, clans assailed them with increasing frequency, and not simply those driven by the extremis of starvation. The ones they cut down as easily as howling dogs. Soon not a day passed without tidings of some grandee or satrap dying on the dusty fields. To Kirgal, the grandee of Maghreb, who had always carried himself with the air of an immortal in council, and so shocked all the more by his passing. Moperol, the bellicose satrap of Tendenharis, whose overbearing manner few would miss. And not a night passed without some pitched battle across the perimeter of the camp, crazed random affairs that often roused the whole of the army, and so contributed to its mounting exhaustion. The Vokalati never ceased walking the low skies to the immediate north, their lavish billows winding like nested snakes, their mouths and eyes aglow. Kites, the men of the circumference began to call them. From dusk to dawn they cast lights across the barren tracts, and without fail they found cohorts of Shrank, sometimes thousands strong, creeping toward the camp with reptilian cunning. Many of the swarthy schoolmen bound themselves to their mules during the day, so they might slumber. Fewer and fewer mustered for the daylight culling. And yet Umrapathur doggedly refused calling on their holy aspect emperor. When the signalers asked what message they should flash across the horizon each evening, he would describe their straits, for he was not so arrogant as to pretend. But he would always conclude with, "All is well with the army of the south." They exchanged horizon for horizon, winking from waste to wilderness to waste. Since the Swayali Grand Mistress had to see the places she delivered them to, the journey was one of stepping, if the madness of sorcery could be called such, from height to height. This made their passage a succession of breathtaking vistas, most of them densely forested, after the first 3 days. Serwa's voice would speak from Sorweel's skin, bind the air about them with light, collapse his physical form into ash, then deliver them to an entirely novel vantage on the rim of the one previous. Usually, when she was not overcome by her arcane exertions, she would tell the two men something about the land beneath their blinking gaze. This was once the province of Unnossiri, the ancient hunting grounds of the Umaritic god-kings. There, see that line of shadow through the trees? That was the Soholm, the great road raised by King Nanner Ukerja the First to speed the passage of his hosts to the frontier. And each time Sorweel would gaze out with a kind of perplexed wonder, trying to imagine what it would be like to possess memories of a distant age. Moengus would typically scowl and cry, "Bah!" Only the Neliost remained constant, a hazy band of dark across the north, and despite the clamor of birdsong, the land seemed hushed for the fact of losses endured so very long ago. From height to height they leapt, a ridgeline crooked like an arthritic finger, a scarp overlooking forests, whose trees dwarfed the greatest Sorweel had ever seen, and the arid envines of Sarkarpus. Once she conveyed them to the summit of a ruined tower, one that proved impossible to climb down from. The conjuring had proved to be particularly difficult, so much so that Moengus had to catch Serwa as she teetered on the brink. The two men found themselves stranded on the ruined summit for watches, waiting for her to recover. Once she conveyed them to an island of stump rock and a river, not realizing that miles of marshland lay just beyond. The three of them were pimpled in mosquito bites before they could escape.
They typically made their leaps, as Moengus called them, twice daily. Though the Swayali Grand Mistress often attempted, and sometimes succeeded, delivering them a third time. Early in the morning, not long after waking, then again in the afternoon, or later, depending on what success Soa had snoozing in the daylight. They struck no fire, relying instead on Serwa's witchcraft to cook the game that Moengus felled with his gorgeous bow. They slept every night, taking turns keeping watch. Soriel would never forget the moonlit worlds he gazed across during his shifts, his ears pricked to the chorus of nocturnal sounds. Not a night passed where he did not steal glimpses of Serwa sleeping. She would seem a thing of polished marble beneath loose cloth, something more dense than the surrounding world, and he would wonder that loneliness could be so beautiful. Sometimes the Princess Imperial did not so much sleep, a swoon. Such was her exhaustion following certain leaps. She often whimpered, or even cried out, while unconscious, prompting Sorwheel to ask Moengus what afflicted her. "The past," he replied, glaring as if troubled by Sorwheel's ignorance. "Same as all those who have touched the shriveled tur that is Seswatha's heart. She dreams of these very lands, dying and shrank in fire. She dreams of father's foe." "The No-God," Sorwheel said numbly. Aeschylus had told him about the first apocalypse, of course. How the shadowy force the Sarkarpai called the Great Ruiner was about to return to finish the destruction of the world. Aeschylus had also moaned and whimpered in his sleep. But if anything, he had complained of his dreams too much, to the point where Sorwheel had made a habit of dismissing them. For whatever reason, the fact that Serwa dreamed these very same dreams troubled him more. "What was it like?" he asked her once. "The first apocalypse?" "Defeat," she replied with inward eyes. "Horror. Anguish." She looked to him with a frowning smile. "And beauty, too, in a strange way." "Beauty?" "The end of nations," she said with uncharacteristic hesitancy. "Few things command the heart with such profundity." "Nations," he repeated.
"Like Sarkarpus?"
"Yes, only exterminated instead of enslaved." She stood as though to put distance between herself and his thin-skinned questions. "And multiplied to the ends of the earth." Twice they heard Shrankhorn's calling, similar, yet eerily different from those heard on the Sarkarpai Pale. On both occasions, the three of them halted whatever they were doing, crooked their heads in pensive listening, and it would seem, to Sorwheel at least, that the end of the world was not so far. The death toll climbed, enough to even provoke King Umrapather's fearless son, Cheropatha, the famed Prince of 100 Songs, to speak out in apprehension. Every morning he led the knights of Invishi into the roiling horizon, and every evening he returned with reports of fomenting danger. "They no longer flee," he told his father. "They scatter only when they see kites in the sky, and those have become all too rare. Soon they will not fear us at all, and they will fall upon us in numbers 10 times greater than before. 10 times or more." "What can we do but march?" King Umrapather cried out in reply. Even though the believer kings understood their collective predicament, the fact that they had no choice but to continue advancing, their fear goaded them to question the manner of their march. Soon even King Mercidides of Syringe, who had been otherwise supportive, and Prince Massar of Kianadini, who saw weakness in all complaints, began speaking out in council. At the very least, the Holy Aspect Emperor had to be consulted.
"Why this stubbornness, King Brother?" Mercidides chided. "Do you fear you will become less in his eyes? Your faith in him should not hang on his faith in you." There was no insolence in these words. All of them knew what it meant to dwell in the presence of their Holy Aspect Emperor, to breathe air relieved of pride and shame, and they sought always to rekindle something of its tenor among themselves.
They did not flinch from the prick of honesty, so long as it was well spoken. So Amrapathur relented. He set aside his pride and commanded the signalers to call the Holy Aspect Emperor with their coated pageants of light. "The horde waxes, Lord Most Holy. The army of the South calls on your strength and wisdom." Less than a watch passed before the signalers, hanging in the sky above the camp's eastern perimeter, saw the reply glitter along the bald nut horizon. "Assemble the believer kings!" Annas Cerimbocellus arrived even as they organized themselves. He wore a common cloak, striding among them without ceremony, clutching shoulders in solemn reassurance. First he questioned them regarding forage and supplies. They starved as the other armies starved, but since the rivers had quickened, their position high on the Nulliost watershed assured them the most plentiful catches of fish. Indeed, many companies marched with flimsy mantles spanning the heads of dozens, covered with fish to dry in the sunlight. Then he questioned them about the horde, heard their multitudinous misgivings. "This is the balance of perils," he said, glaring down from his halo. "You are exposed for the sake of sustenance. To undo the one is to undo the other. I will send you Zacharies. I can do no more." And with that, he winked out of existence. To a man the believer kings of the South rejoiced, for Aperin's Zacharies was the grand master of the Mandate, the Aspect Emperor's own school. Only Karindusu, who could not set aside his scholastic rivalries even here, thousands of miles from his fastness in Invishi, scoffed. What could the Mandate do that the Vokalati could not do as well, if not better? "Double your numbers," the ever-witty Mercidides declared to uproarious laughter. The Grand Master withdrew, embittered. The Mandate schoolmen arrived the following midday, bearing only what they could carry with them across the low sky. The great columns of infantrymen watched with wonder as the sorcerers filed across the flashing sun, their crimson silk billows hanging like windless flags. And so the number of kites flown by the army of the South was doubled. More than 300 sorcerers of rank and some 200 more understudies now strode through the sepulchral clouds above the horde. They crossed it as sparks from a grass fire, as a light leaping. Kunieri, the fabled land of his ancestors. Not even 2,000 years could undo the glory of its works. It seemed a great vessel clinging to the surface of an earthen sea, wrecked and derelict, too powerfully wrought to founder, too vast to entirely drown. Humped fortifications, overgrown processionals, mounded temples. It would linger for another 2,000 years, so Weel realized, even if only as featureless stones kissed by the sun. And this, he found himself thinking, was not such a bad thing, to find immortality in your bones. "Do you ever ponder?" Sarah asked him once, watching him gaze across a field of vine-draped debris. Her voice startled him, since he had thought her asleep. "Ponder? The apocalypse," she said, rubbing the bridge of her nose. "How your city survive when far greater bastions toppled?" The young king of Sarkarpus shrugged. "Some live, some die. My father always said it was a good thing that men could only trust in the whore when it comes to battle. He believed men should be wary of war." She smiled in appreciation. "But you do see it, don't you?"
"See what?"
"Evidence. Proof of my holy father." Something balked within him. Balked at the lies about to be told. Even in childhood, he had always been an honest, even earnest, soul. He gazed into her clear blue eyes, trusting in the mask the dread mother had given him. "My friend, Zaranga, he thinks your consult is a myth, and
that my father is mad."
"Yes. But he saw the skin spy father unmasked in the umbilicus.
Months back? Yes."
Her scowl was quizzical enough to be alarming. "And?"
He thought it a trick. Of course he did. The Zayumi are stubborn fools. Now it was Sorwheel's turn to scowl. He could feel the danger, the slippery tumble of word and passion, that prefaced every argument. Yet he erred against caution once again. "Better a fool than a slave," he snapped in reply. Boldness, it seemed, was its own shelter. Her expression hung in blank equipoise, as if deciding whether to be offended or amused. "You are not like the others. You do not speak as a believer king." "I am not like the others." Then she asked the dreaded question. "But you do believe, don't you? Or has your stubborn Zayumi friend robbed you of your conviction?" The assumption was plain. Her father had declared him a believer king, therefore he simply had to be a believer, at least at some point. Once again Sorwheel found himself marveling at the strange power the goddess and her deception had afforded him. Knowledge. This was the great fortress the Anasarimbra had raised about themselves. And somehow he had found his way past the gates, into the very bosom of his adversary. He was Narindari, as Zaronga had said. He, and he alone, was capable of murdering the Aspect Emperor. He need only summon the courage to die. "Is doubt such a bad thing?" he asked, blinking to recover his concentration. "Would you rather I be a fanatic like the others?" She glared at him, five heartbeats of scrutiny, unnerving for the glint of preternatural canniness in her Anasarimbra eyes. "Yes," she finally said. "Most assuredly, yes. I have battled Shariatas in my dreams. I have been tortured by Makaratrik, chased across Aerwa by Alrax and Alrang. The consult is real as it is wicked and deadly, Sorwheel. Short of my father, the world knows no powers more ferocious. Even absent the No-God in the second apocalypse, they warrant the bloodthirsty fanaticism of men." If anything, her voice had grown softer in speaking these words. Yet the intensity of her look and inundation shocked the young king of Sarkarpus. For all her allure and arcane potency, Anasarimbra Serwa had always seemed arrogant and flip like her brothers, another child too aware of her divine paternity. Now she reminded him of Aeschylus, and the way the portly schoolman had tucked his zealotry between the folds of his wit and compassion. This was the true Serwa, he realized, the earnest one, and her beauty seemed to blaze all the brighter for it. He found himself staring at her breathless. Leaf shadows bobbed across the perfect lines of her face. "Don't be a fool, Sorwheel." She turned on her rump to kick her snoring brother. No schoolman was as famed as Aperin Saccharis, who had long stood high among the Empire's exalt ministers. His voice proved a tonic for the Army of the South's nightly war councils, for it carried both the authority of their Aspect Emperor and the promise of tactical acumen. Like all Mandate schoolmen, he dreamed the first apocalypse through the eyes of Seswatha, and so could speak of their straits with the wisdom of one who had suffered them before. Many times. "In Adiursus," he said, referring to the Mandate's famed citadel, "we have whole libraries dedicated to warring against the Shrank. Centuries have we dreamed the battles of old. Centuries have we pondered the debacles and the successes." The Grand Master of the Vokaladi, however, was not impressed in the least. Such is the perversity of pride that it can drive a man to embrace contradiction, so long as some semblance of his privilege is preserved. Karindusu, who had been among the first to warn of their growing peril, now became the first to discount the ominous declarations made by others, and Saccharis especially. "Why do you speak of them so?" the Inbitic Grand Master asked, his oiled features gleaming with derision. "They are naught but brutes, vicious beasts, to be herded with care, certainly, but to be herded nonetheless." "Beasts to be herded," Saccharis replied, scowling. "They speak their own tongue. They forge their own weapons, when they cannot scavenge ours. The bliss we find in coupling they find in murder of innocents. They gather when we trod their earth, drawn from lands far from our stink on the wind. When overmatched, they withdraw of their own nature, gouging all life from the earth before us, denying us the least sustenance. And when they come to dwarf our numbers, they assail us with suicidal ardour, throw themselves upon our spears simply to deny us our weapons. The Grand Master of the Mandate glanced from face to face to ensure that all present grasped the dire significance of his words. "Do you think this a mere coincidence, Karandusu?" "They are beasts," the tall Vokalati schoolman said. "No, Karandusu, please. You must forgive my insistence. They are weapons. They are designed thus, hewn from the flesh of non-men by the Ikoroi, to purge this world of souls, to exterminate men. Beasts live to survive, my old friend. Shrank live to kill." And so was Karandusu shamed a second time. The culling was reorganized under Sakari's direction. As the army of the south veered westward, the Vokalati had simply spread themselves across the entirety of the horde, facing them. Since the clans accumulated along their right flank posed the greatest threat, Sakari's, with Karandusu's grudging assent, dedicated all the Mandate and Vokalati, some 300 sorcerers of rank, to their extermination. For the long-suffering pickets, the vision of so many kites sailing into the enormous bowers of dust was a thing of cheering joy and wonder. "Like watching angels drag skirts of fire," Prince Cecil Charapatha reported to his father. Arrayed in cadres of 3 triunes, the schoolmen walked the high-hanging veils, their wards turning aside flurries of arrows and javelins, their cants scorching the shadows that raced shrieking beneath. The violence of the horde's flight kicked ever more dust into the sky, so piling obscurity atop obscurity, until the schoolmen could scarce see their own apparitional defenses, let alone the ground seething beneath. Since nothing singular could be heard above the cavernous roar, they could not even rely on their ears to guide them. So their mouths and eyes alight, they lashed out blindly, swept the ground with Kiroi looms, dragon heads, Gatagan scythes, and more, destroying the gibbering mobs they saw more in their soul's eye than in fact. They advanced in hellish echelon, using the glow of the triunes flanking to pace their progress into the ochre gloom. Shouting their voices to croaks, they chased the far flank of the horde out into the droughted wastes, only to find it return the following morning. Since the Shrank cannibalized their dead, evidence of their efficacy was difficult to find. The cavalry pickets who crossed the sorcerer's wake counted the dead as they had been instructed. The imperial mathematicians argued estimates, and the believer kings continually bent their darling ear, as the Nunameshi put it, to the numbers that most flattered their hopes. But Sakari's was not fooled, no more than Karandusu. "This number is irrelevant," he finally cried to King Umrapathur. "The effect is all that matters." This put an end to their numerical speculations, for everyone knew that despite the cunning and fury of their efforts, the schoolmen had accomplished nothing that any man could discern. Their predicament, if anything, had become more perilous. Not only did the horde seem to be swelling along their flank, it had grown mobbing tendrils that hooked about their rear. Shrank, unaccounted thousands of them, now followed the army. Once again Umrapathur was forced to set aside his pride and call upon the Aspect Emperor. This time their lord and god came to them chalked in dust, bearing the crackling aura of sorceries dispensed. In their soul's eye, the believer kings could see him striding alone into the inhuman horde, racking the masses that thronged about him with cataclysmic light.
"Indeed," he said, favoring Cecil Amrapather with a nod. "Your peril is great. You are wise to call me, Umra." Crisis, he told the assembled caste nobles, was inevitable. The best they could hope to achieve was to weaken the Horde in tactically advantageous ways so that they might survive the inevitable assault. Henceforth you must encircle yourselves with your might, camp curled as caterpillar, armed against all directions. The advance pickets were thinned to a handful of companies, while the bulk of the army's horsemen, the heavily armored knights of Nilnamesh, and the far more fleet riders of Girgash and Kianadini concentrated on clearing the southern tracks of Shrank, in concert with the schoolmen. At the Aspect Emperor's direction, they adopted the extravagant hunting tactics of the far antique Nocerai kings, who would use their hosts to encircle entire provinces and so drive all the beasts of the land to slaughter. The schoolmen filed out into the depths of the plain, then arrayed themselves behind the Shrank, so they could drive them into far-flung arcs of horsemen. It seemed they herded clouds with staffs of light, for the men marching in the main host. Half the world was fenced in mountainous dust. But it was like digging holes in loose sand. For every 1,000 they gouged clear, another 1,000 came collapsing in from the sides. And the losses, especially among the unarmored ponies, rose to unsustainable levels. As ever, death came swirling down. Pasu Herminda, the even-handed satrap of Shranayati, was lost, pulled down by a crazed Shrank chieftain. So too was Prince Hemret, the eldest son of King Urkmak III, killed. Despite these losses, despite the relentless heroism of their efforts, the numbers of Shrank trailing the Army of the South seemed to grow at an increasing rate, to the point where the cavalrymen found themselves mired in pitched battles rather than riding down panic swarms. Then, on the sixth day of the hunt, as it had come to be called, some 5 companies of Nilnameshi knights under Satrap Arsogol were out and out overwhelmed, and the Saranji marines, who were tasked with guarding the army's rear, found themselves beset by several 1,000 Shrank. "They seek each other out," Sacrisy said to the dismayed believer kings, "like schooling fish or flocking birds, so that the presence of few licenses the gathering of many." Far from clearing the clans from their rear, he explained, "they actually were pressing them further afield, so opening ever greater tracks for innumerable others to occupy. Their efforts to clear their flanks were leading to their encirclement." "Could it be," Karandusu asked in derision, "have the fabled dreams of the first apocalypse led the illustrious Sacrisy astray?" "Yes," the Mandate Grandmaster replied, his honesty so genuine, his humility so reminiscent of their lord and god, that Karandusu found himself shamed before his peers a third time. "What we face, the world has never seen the like." They sat, as always, side by side, before the octagonal iron hearth, master and disciple. "Mathanet," the Aspect Emperor said, "my brother has seized control in Momen. After so many years, Proyas suffered only the most subtle urges to lie or save face. The merest hesitations were all that remained of his old instincts, to write himself large in the eyes of others. This time it was instinct to conceal his dismay. Before he had found Kellis, he had made himself into Mathanet's disciple. And over the years since the First Holy War, he had come to love Esmenet as a sister, as much as he revered her as the wife of his lord and god. To think one could usurp the other, it seemed impossible." "What could have happened?" he asked. The fire seemed to sputter for the tidings as much as Proyas's heart labored. If Mathanet, the Shrier of the 1,000 Temples, had revolted against his brother, the empire itself teetered. "For some reason, Esme suspected Matha of sedition," Kallus said without the least whisper of remorse or concern.
and so called him to account before Enrilitus. The interrogation went wrong, horribly wrong, and my brother ended up killing my son. He looked down at his haloed palms, and Proyas found it curiously affecting, the contrast between his tone and his manner. I know little more than this. The exalt general breathed deep and nodded. What do you intend to do? Gather as much knowledge as possible, the Holy Aspect Emperor replied, his head still bowed. I yet have resources in Momin. Since the beginning, Anesarim Berkelis had possessed a peculiar density of presence, as if he were the lone iron ingot among shards of clay and stone, invulnerable to what would smash others to powder. But with each of these remarkable sessions, the more his density seemed to leak from him. So much so, the exalt general suffered the demented urge to prick him, just to see if he would bleed. Faith, he upbraided himself. Faith! Do you... Proyas paused, recognizing the implications of what he was about to ask. Do I fear for Esme? Kellis asked. He turned, his friend smiling. You wonder, as you have wondered your whole life, what passions bind me. He closed his eyes in resignation. And whether they are human. So here it was, the question of questions. Yes. Love, the Holy Aspect Emperor said, is for lesser souls.